All right, we bring in the third base coach on this Saturday night. Will, how are you?
Marty, I'm doing fantastic. I'm over at my mother-in-law's house, and we have some family down from Santa Rosa, and we're socially distancing a little get-together. And, you know, it's just such a great weekend with it being Mother's Day weekend. So it's really nice to see some family and to do some normal activity for once.
Yeah, and I know in your family, it's your mom has always been very important, going back to see her when you can back east. And Lori fills such a void in the family with so many people that it is a special weekend for you guys.
Yeah, it is. No, there's no doubt about it. And especially, you know, being away from Connecticut. My mom's back in Connecticut, and I've been out in California for a long, long time now, over 30 years. And, you know, every time I talk to my mom about every other day, and she is always so upbeat and positive, and she lives alone, and it's not easy for moms, but like they do, you know, raising us and taking care of us. She never has a bad day when I call, and is always there for you. So my heart goes out to all the moms out there, and thank you for everything that you do.
Yeah, now also, now does she give you advice on baseball?
Not so much. She follows, though. You know, even being on the East Coast, it's hard to get the scores. You know, she complains about that a little bit. You know, I mean, you got to get the paper. Sometimes there's a day behind, but she's not much of a complainer. But everybody on the East Coast knows that sometimes it's hard during the season to follow the West Coast teams. But no, she watches it like a hawk.
All right. You know, it's funny. And my mother lived into her 90s and was a great baseball fan of in Miami, the Miami Marlins. But I probably have told you this story before. She couldn't stand Braden Looper. And remember, he became the closer for the Marlins. And I don't think it went well. I think it was trouble. And she would call me up and say, why are they bringing him in? You know, those are the calls I used to get. But it's a good weekend. I'm glad we could share it together again. And, you know, in my family with Christina and Barbara and Robin and Bonnie and Marlene and Carol and all the people who, you know, are the mothers of the family. I appreciate it. So, well, how you doing? How's your week going?
It's fine. You know, just plugging along. You know, nothing too exciting, but just waiting for things to open up a little bit and get baseball back. So I had a good week and looking forward to this weekend as well. And tonight with you and Bill on the radio.
All right, and that's a good segue to bring in Bill Lasky. Bill, how are you?
Good evening, fellas. Another Saturday night with both of you. I'm hoping both of you are well. It sounds like you both are doing fine. Marty, you're ready to come up here in Northern California, get away from the heat. And I know Ron and I are enjoying a beautiful weekend in Northern California. So it's good. Another good solid week. And looking forward to all this new news coming out for Major League Baseball this week on Monday to the owners, Tuesday to the players, and hopefully we'll see Ron Wotus in June coaching third.
Yep. I think it's going to happen. We just have to be patient, but I think it's going to happen. Hey, to start us off tonight, you know, a few of the things that we like to talk about. And, well, we've touched on this, and Bill, we have as well. And that's some of the coaches over the years. And this week, you know, I love to look up this day in baseball history. And in baseball history, Mariano Rivera got save number, 265 or so, 266, something like that. And he broke the record of the Yankee reliever who had the most saves. And I didn't realize this, and that was Dave Righetti. And it made me think of the coaching staff, of Righetti and Rags. And we touched on Mark Gardner a couple of weeks ago, but I thought it's good to spotlight Righetti. And, well, he was a major, major star in the big leagues, and he became the pitching coach here. What was it like working with Rags?
Well, Bill knows Rags as well, and it was fantastic because, you know, I actually go way back with Rags. We were drafted. He was drafted a couple of years before me. Way back in 1979, or it was 1980, I was in instructional league with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we shared the complex with the Yankees. And Rags was in that camp, along with Tim Lawlor, Willie McGee. They had a great team down there. Of course, they were the New York Yankees. Of course, I didn't know him, but, you know, watching him pitch and knew a little bit about him, because he was so highly touted as a prospect. But working with Rags was fantastic. You know, he's one of the few guys that was a great player. You know, did a nice job as a starter, transitioned into the closer, obviously, which is very unique. So he had a unique perspective there, being a starter and a great closer, as you mentioned. And he was just a pro's pro. And I had great times. We had continuity together with him, and Sabes kept us all together, and there's no way. I mean, I can go on and on here, but I'll let Bill talk a little bit. But there's no way we'd have won those championships without the job he did with the pitching staff, because that was our strength. You know, our backbone was the pitching, and he was a big reason for our success.
Well, I think the first thing is him growing up here in Northern California and then playing on the East Coast with the Yankees and just dominating a career there. It's like Ron said, being a starter most of his career. Of course, we all remember the no-hitter July 4th date always comes up. And then transferring into a closer in such a dominance role, Dennis Eckersley did it, probably a couple other pitchers I can't remember doing it, but it is a difficult scenario of setting up your mind, setting up how you prepare, and then finalizing, getting out there in those clutch situations and doing it. And he was outstanding. Now, going on the pitching coach's side, I just loved sometimes standing next to him, watching guys throwing aside, just hearing him pick out little things, just little tidbit of a shoulder or a lean, and his knowledge was just right there. And every pitcher just stopped and listened to him. And that's what a pitching coach has, that communication. And he look at the staffs that he had, from Lincecum, Kane, all the big name players, pitchers, I should say. And he handled it with care. He handled it with dignity. And all those pitchers really followed his leadership. And that's why I think he's probably with one of the best pitching coaches the Giants have ever had.
Well, I'll say, and his father was a great player in the Pacific Coast League, Leo Rigetti. Played. He was a shortstop, I think, for the Seals, and Dave Rigetti always had that feeling. Well, what was he like in the dugout in crunch time? Because you know, he and Bochy were pretty close there, and you were right there with him. What was he like crunch time?
Yeah, well, I think to sum Rags up is, you know, Rags was a great player, and obviously rubbed elbows with a lot of great teammates along the way, and he pretty much was always under control. You know, he never got flustered. As Bill mentioned, he had everybody's respect, but he taught what he lived, and he didn't overreact to things. He's always kept his composure. You know, Rags is a very proud guy, and, you know, he always jogged out to the mound and jogged back. He was, you know, I hate to use the word, but he was an old school guy. He you know, he expected you to give the best and gave you the rope to do the job that you were asked to do, and he treated you like a man. You know, he gave you enough rope. Now, he wouldn't let you hang yourself with that rope, but he was one of those old school guys that had people's respect, taught what he knew as a player, was honest, and really cared about the pitcher. And he was fantastic. As I said, he was never flustered. He never overreacted to the situations. And he was as steady as he come. And, you know, that he came up with a great organization that had a lot of great players that they approached the game like that. And I really enjoyed his professionalism with everything that he did along the way.
You know, one of the things, Ron, that I loved about him and being a pitcher and pitching coach that I've been here and there is how he did manage the game with his pitchers, sitting next to him in between innings. And I loved it when he got thrown out a few games for chirping about strike zone or, you know, just the flavor of the game from the pitching staff. And those, I know, Ron, you probably know, a good handful of times he came out of the dugout chirping at that home plate umpire. The other thing,
Bill, he liked to throw his clicker, too. He liked to throw his clicker at the umpire, too. Don't forget that.
I was just going to say that clicker's got a few dents in it, too. But that's what's great. You know, when you have a pitching coach that's fired up like that, and especially being a superior athlete he was, he is going to bark when he needs to bark on that strike zone, especially with Posey and, you know, Sanchez behind the plate. They framed that ball so well. And he knows that strike zone just like anybody else.
Did you ever see the video of that the no-hitter on July 4th that he threw and got Boggs at the last out?
Yeah. It was, we always talk about it. We always give him a little ribbing July 4th when we're together. Obviously, the day he threw the no-hitter, and we'd say, hey, Rags, you know, fans love Dave, and we go to New York, and everybody would want his autograph, and the fans would come up, and they'd say, hey, Rags, I was there. They would say, well, you know, about the no-hitter. So every time it was July 4th, I'd go, hey, Rags, I was there.
No, it was great. I'm really happy to talk about it because he had the Yankee record. We had the Yankee record of the great Yankees for saves, and Mariano Rivera broke it. So that came up this week. So I'm glad that we could spotlight Dave Rigetti. One last, before we leave it, I'll ask this question. I have no idea what the answer is, but Bill, how did Dave Rigetti deal with Lincecum? Did he just leave him alone and just let him do what he does?
Go ahead, Ron. You were there more than I was with him. I would assume he probably didn't do much.
Yeah, you know what? Rags was a pro's pro. I mean, he didn't try to control a pitcher or ram his advice down their throats. As I said, he gave them the rope. He let them be themselves. And, you know, it's a totally different personality of Dave Rigetti to Tim Lincecum. But he let him be Tim. And, you know, when the times were right, and the times he needed to be spoke to, or if Rags thought he was doing something that was going to be a detriment to him or the team, he'd sit him down and talk. And that was the thing. I mean, everybody respected Dave so much that, you know, they listened. They listened when he spoke. And I think the big thing is he gave people a lot of motivation by letting them do their job. They knew who was in charge, but Rags let them be themselves and do their job, and he would keep them in line when he needed to. So he got along with everybody. He knew how to adapt to the different personalities.
Nice. All right, that sums it up pretty good. All right, very good. Hey, watching baseball all week long, a couple of things I saw that we'll talk about, but one was I saw a lot of Pirate games for some reason this week, and a lot of them in the 90s with Barry Bonds. And, of course, Bonds, when he came here. Well, and I thought I'd ask you guys this question. We don't dwell on it enough or talk about it enough, but Barry Bonds is a defensive player before bulking up. He was one heck of a left fielder. And, I want to get your take on it because we've never really talked Bonds on defense.
Yeah, well, you know, we were teammates in Hawaii in 1986. Barry and I, and you know, he's known as such a good athlete, and obviously his home run record and hitting all the home runs have overshadowed the type of player he was when he was earlier in his career. But you're right, he was an outstanding defender. I mean, he had speed. He didn't have a tremendous arm, but he had a quick release. And the thing that I liked about him, he always knew where to position. I mean, he was on a different level when it came to the mental side of the game. He knew where the pitchers were going to throw. He didn't need a map or a chart. He knew where the hitters were going to hit the ball. And he was always in the right position. But the thing that he was really, really good at, in my opinion, was moving to the third baseline, the left field line, on a single, holding that batter to a single. He would go to the line, do that reverse pivot, throw the ball to second base, as good as anybody I've seen. So he doesn't get enough credit, obviously, for the defender that he was. But he was no slouch. He was very good out there. No question about it, Marty.
Well, you know, one of the first things that comes to mind every time, because Jim Leland was a great friend of mine back in Toledo, was the Jim Leland, Barry Bonds fiasco at, in spring training when they taped it. ESPN showed it 100 times that day when Jim Leland and Barry Bonds just got into a screaming match. And literally, that was pretty much what Jim Leland, how he conquered that team, because he stood up and he went right toe-to-toe with them, and he was not going to let Barry win that argument. And all the other teammates and everybody was around him, and Leland and him were going at it for a while. But, you know, Barry Bonds, when he came up with Pittsburgh, just looking at some of his numbers, he had phenomenal numbers, phenomenal. 34 home runs his last year there. RBIs up, slugging percentage up, over 400. It's just remarkable the numbers he put up in Pittsburgh and then coming to the Giants and, of course, extended a great career here.
the arm was, where was the arm? The arm was okay, wasn't it, Woe?
Yeah, I'd say it was average early in his career. It wasn't above average, but he had a quick release.
Yeah, I was thinking about it as you were talking about the thing on the left field line. Ricky Henderson, for me, could get to that ball and turn just like you described Barry doing and getting rid of it. And it made me think of outfielders because I saw Johnny Damon play when he came to the Bay Area. I saw Mark Kotze play here. And, well, you remember these guys, not great arms, but somehow they got to the ball very quickly and got rid of it very quickly, almost like an infielder, and that compensated for the arm.
Yeah, no, you're right, Marty. I mean, as a third base coach, anyone will tell you, whether it's Flan or myself or Glenn Hoffman, the quicker the outfielder gets to the ball, you know, it stops a lot of guys from advancing, because me as a third base coach, if that guy sprints to the ball and gets to it, you know, I'm judging where the runner is when he picks up the ball. So even if he doesn't have a great arm, that could stop you from sending a guy. And you're right. The guys with speed in the outfield that charge the ball hard, and they have a quick release. I mean, when we look at the scouting reports, we just don't always look at arm strength. We do talk about, hey, the guy's good getting to the ball. We talk about maybe he's bad moving to his left or to his right, but if he's coming straight in, he throws accurate. So all those things make a difference. They go unknown a little bit, but not to the baseball people, not to the third base coaches. And you're right, it makes a huge difference in their outfield play.
You know, the speed and the first step always when you look at a good outfielder, it's always the anticipation of where the ball's going. Ron, you teach this all the time too, and it really means a lot as a center fielder to take that little step, or left fielder to try to take the line or the gap. We go back to Barry Bonds. That's what he was really good at. He really covered the gap and the line extremely well. One of the names that keeps coming to mind was Melky Cabrera when he played left field. I thought he did really well. But all those guys hit the cutoff, man. And I know, Ron, you teach it a lot, and so does the Giants. And getting out to that cutoff man to hit Crawford or hit Panic or the second baseman out there, all those guys could do that in the outfield, hit that infield really quick. And that really shows you, if you get to the ball, you don't have to have that cannon of an arm, as long as you can get it, engage your infielder for that cutoff. And I think Barry and all those names we just threw out there, from Johnny Damon and all of them, I thought they did that extremely well.
You know, it made me think, whoa, Clemente didn't need a cutoff man. He would just, and also Mays. Mays always said, I didn't need a cutoff man. Did you run into outfielders like that who just said, you know, look, I don't need a cutoff man. I know where I'm throwing the ball, and that's where it's going.
Well, you know, if a guy's got that great of an arm, you know, you want them to be able to throw the ball low enough where the batter runner or the trail runner sees that the throw can be cut. They necessarily aren't always throwing to the cutoff man if they're throwing a guy out at the plate. I mean, they're trying to throw the guy out at the plate, but they throw the ball low enough where if the first baseman needs to cut that ball and redirect it to second, it can be done. So when you're a trail runner and you see that ball thrown on a string and it's low, you don't take the extra base. And the guys you're talking about with the great arms, they're pretty much saying, you know, they're not going to throw the ball up in the air like trying to, you know, bring rain. They're going to throw it on a line so the batter runner doesn't know if it's going to get caught, so they're going to have to freeze. So that's what most of the guys with good arms, you know, do, and that's what you want them to do.
You know, the first guy that comes to mind was Jack Clark when you said that, Marty. He hated guys cutting the ball. He wanted to throw a bolt to second, third, and home every time. And he had a cannon for an arm. Corey Snyder, another one that really played right field real well at Candlestick. Both those guys, and you had to at Candlestick and right field because of the winds, and you had gaps in the corner. So those are the two guys that nobody wanted to cut the ball because, one, the ball was going to be thrown like a bullet, and second of all, they'll probably stare you down if you cut it.
That's right, yeah.
Got it. All right. You know, it's fun doing these things and, you know, going back through some of these events, and you hear it on KMBR or you watch it on TV, and names come up, and I thought – a couple of weeks ago, well, when we talked about Ramon Martinez, I hadn't thought about him in 30 years or 20 years, whatever it was. But here's another one that's rather current, but we've never really touched on him, is Freddie Lewis. What about Freddie Lewis as a ball player?
Yeah. Well, Freddie came up. He was a pretty, you know, he wasn't a number one pick, but everybody liked his tools. He had great speed. He had arm strength, and he had bat speed. And so, you know, if you can hone those skills, you could be a, you know, an everyday player in the major league with those type of skills. And I think Freddie's his strength was his offense. When he made it as a big leaguer, he gave you a pretty good at bat, and he had some bat speed, and that was his strength. Unfortunately for him, he never utilized his tools to his best ability in the outfield. He was a below average outfielder. He had some rough moments out there, and even though he had the speed, he was a little bit unsure of himself and never developed into the outfielder that he could have been. And, you know, he didn't have a long career, but we got some good years out of him, and great bat speed for Freddie Lewis.
He sure did have the bat speed. He had that whip in the bat. I remember Freddie Lewis real well as a hitter, and I think you hit it right in the nose, Ron. He was a subpar outfielder, and he could have easily been a lot better because he had the speed. He had a decent arm. He just didn't do well in the outfield, but as a hitter, I do believe he hit for a cycle in one of his years there with the Giants. I remember that. And then just moving around a lot toward the end of his career, it seemed like he was with one or two teams each year just trying to get a shot. I think he had a little time with Toronto, maybe somebody else. But I think Ron hit it on the head. As a hitter, I think he could have been a little better, but he still had great whip, good swing path. Outfield, he could have been a lot better.
Yeah, interesting. You're right, Bill. I think he did have, I was thinking of that when you guys were talking. I think he did have a cycle. Didn't he? Well,
he did.
Right?
Yeah. I just wanted to say he did. And I wanted to say, was it on Mother's Day? It may even have been on Mother's Day. And it might have been in Colorado. I'm not sure, but that's in the back
that's
of my head.
One, yeah.
Somewhere. I don't know.
Good call.
All right. Someone will look that up, believe me, and we'll get a text on that. Very good. Hey, I did a show, or thought about doing a show, and we're going to have Marcos Breton on from Sacramento. Wonderful writer. There was a story in The Athletic this week about a ballpark, and it's before your time in the PCL, Woe, and Bill, in Sacramento. And they played at a place called Hughes Stadium. And the left field was 233 feet with a 40-foot wall because it was, you know, a football stadium and the PCL team was moved there and they didn't have a place to play and that's where they moved them into. And 305 home runs were hit there during the season and Bill McNulty hit 55 and Gorman Thomas hit 51 and all that. And I was just thinking of you guys and I was thinking quirky minor league parks. And there must be a million of them. And, you know, you've seen so many in your travels. And I was going to throw that out to Bill. I'll let you start with that one. Quirky minor league parks. You remember any?
I'm going to stay right in that PCL in Portland. Portland did the same thing. Portland had a real short left field wall. It was like Fenway Park. And it was a bandbox. Like you couldn't even a fly ball would get out of there. And then the other ones, you go down to the Southern League. So many in the Southern League from Savannah. And even Jacksonville, where I played the Jacksonville Suns, it was so strange of a ballpark. Wind would blow out one way, and then the bridge would be in right field, and you'd see the clouds move in, and you knew it was going to be a storm. Just some of the things I remember in the Southern League. Of course, Florida State League, you played in all the top spring trainings of the big leagues. But I would say the worst park I ever played with would be Portland.
Okay.
Yeah, well, Bill, I got to tell you, that was my home park in 1982 with the Pirates. So I was in
a quirky park.
Yes, no, they had the lady out there on the left field wall. It was like the Green Monster. She was like diving into the ocean, right? I mean, she was the full length. I mean, it was kind of like Rusty out in our park, but she was horizontal on the outfield wall. It was a unique ballpark, but the one I started at in 1982 was very unique as well, and that was the old Rock Pile, Buffalo, New York. We played at Old War Memorial Stadium where The Natural was filmed and O.J. did all his damage, but the thing that was unique about it was it had a real short right field porch, like you mentioned, Marty, you know, short walls. It was like 275 to right field. And that was good news for me because I was a right field hitter and I hit 11 home runs in half a season in Buffalo. And I was by no means a home run hitter. And Marty, I'll tell you, the other park that was very similar and quirky was I was sent to a co-op team the year before that, 1981, in Hagerstown, Maryland. Now, Hagerstown didn't have baseball. I think the last person hit a home run there was Willie Mays in their ballpark. And then we come back, I don't know, 20, 30 years later, and they put a co-op team in there, and our manager was Grady Little, and I was with the Pirates, and they sent me to Hagerstown. But again, it had a short center field wall. It was a 20-foot-high brick wall, and it was about 270 to center field. And I loved it again because my first at-bat of the season for the Hagerstown, I hit a home run. And I come back in my second at-bat. Yeah, wait till you hear this. I come back in my second at-bat of the season, and I step in the box, and the announcer takes it upon himself to say, now batting, number 7, Ron Boom Boom Wota. And I stepped out of the box, and I looked up at this guy. I couldn't believe it. And to this day, I have players that played against me in this league that call me Boom Boom. And the end of the story is I hit 3 more home runs that season.
That's funny. That's so in War Memorial Stadium, well, you went Oppo to right field.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, right field. Yeah.
Boy, mate. Well, it's interesting because this Sacramento thing, 233 and, you know, all these home runs, and it made me think, and boy, I didn't realize there were that many minor league parks that were that goofy. So in the minor leagues also, now, I don't know if they did it with you guys, but if you hit a home run, whoa, you hit big home runs there. Did they ever take up a collection, you know, like they show in the moon, the Bull Durham and all that stuff? Did that ever happen?
And no, I was never part of that, but I've seen that happen, no doubt about it. They'd have those home runs, and you pass the hat around for the guys. But no, my home runs were few and far between. I needed those quirky ballparks to be able to hit them out.
Bill, did you actually hit these parks? Did you hit down there? Bill?
No, what I was going to say is in Omaha, they had a thing where if you hit a home run to right center, they gave you a free pair of cowboy boots. And everybody was trying to go out to right center field and get the boots. But they also gave a lot of different things at ballparks. You know, they gave put a can out in left center field and $500 if you hit the can, you know, things like that. You know, like targets. But that was what's great about the minor leagues. You had the double fence where you had the home run fence and then a fence behind it so you could see how far the ball would travel. But so many minor league parks, especially in the Southern League, East Coast, Texas League, boy, there's just some bad ballparks. And now they pretty much probably took them all down, Ron. They probably have big exclusive stadiums now because most of them are.
Did they let you hit?
When, in AAA?
And anywhere. Did you have, what kind of hitter were you?
Oh, yeah, in AAA. Yeah, we hit in AAA. We had, when we played National League teams, we played American Association. That's what we did. But I came up with the Kansas City Royals, so they DH'd all the time. But we got to hit against National League teams.
Could you hit at all?
129, Marty.
Did you ever hit?
Hey, Billy, you hit the ball hard, though. I didn't get right at somebody. You hit it hard,
I could
though.
Punt with the best of them. That's all I could do. Get the punt down. I was happy with that.
Did you ever hit one out?
You know, you were talking about Tom Seaver last week, and that was the closest one when he was with the Reds. I hit one, and Eddie Miller leaped in left center field, and pulled it in. It was the third out of the inning. He came in, and he was a good friend of mine. And he had the ball in his glove just gleaming with it. You could see the Eddie Miller smile. And that was the closest I ever got. And that would have been a great story to hit one off of Tom Seaver being the only home run. But that was the closest I got, Marty, and Ron.
That's good. That's good. Hey, Doug Greenwald, of course, we love Doug and a wonderful announcer in Fresno, sent me a text. And it says, Fred Lewis's first major league home run came in his cycle at Colorado. And the cycle was on Mother's Day in 2007. Whoa, pretty good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Call, Ron.
I thought that was it. I thought he had that pink bat in his hand, and I thought he was going to use it the rest of the year. He should have probably used it the rest of the year. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for verifying that, Mr. Greenwald. Great.
Yeah, yeah, very good. All right, we'll take a break. Always great to talk ball with these guys. Chris Haft has got a new book that is coming out, and it's out. It's called From the Stick to the Cove, My 6 Decades with the San Francisco Giants. And you guys know it's Mike Murphy's story that he told with Chris, and it's really a lot of fun. So I thought it'd be good to, number one, of course, mention the book, and number two, get your thoughts about Murph. There's got to be a few Murph stories for you guys. So we'll come back and talk to you guys about it right after this.
Talking baseball with Marty Lurie on KNBR 104.5 and 680, the sports leader.